Hello, and welcome to the Turkish History Podcast. Episode 15. Talas. So before we begin today, I would like to address the situation currently unfolding in Turkey and in Syria. As I'm sure you know, two massive earthquakes have just decimated southern Turkey and northern Syria. The footage is just absolutely heartbreaking, and the environment in the country is unbelievable. We are currently watching an unfolding humanitarian catastrophe. At least 20,000 people are dead already, and no one knows how many more may die. Thousands more are injured and suffering in the cold. So I would ask you please to do whatever you can to help the situation, whether that's acting locally to gather supplies and donations, or donating to any one of the wonderful charities that are currently working to make the situation better. If you haven't donated yet, I would recommend donating to AHBAP, AHBAP.org, or AKUT, AKUT.org. Okay, so now to return to the story. So last episode, we covered the Abbasid Revolution, the overthrow of the Umayyad Caliphate by revolutionaries from the eastern fringe of the empire. Now, as we discussed, the Turks were critical players in the Abbasid Revolution, both in inadvertently causing the conditions that led to the revolution, see Suluk Khan's 20-year war with the Caliphate, which completely destabilized the frontier region, and in the revolution itself, see Abu Muslim's Turkish cavalry troops. And the Turks are going to be key players in the Abbasid Caliphate, first by continuing their role as soldiers for the state, but then coming to be its rulers. It is indeed here, with the rise of the Abbasids, that the Turks really enter the Muslim world permanently and begin to shape its history. But if you think back through to the earlier episodes of the podcast, there was another civilization that acted as a gravitational pull, pulling the Turks toward it and shaping Turkish history. And of course, I'm talking about China. Indeed, as I said in the very first episode, one of the most important things to know about early Turkish history is that the Turks emerged in close contact with Chinese civilization. And that remained true throughout all of the history we've covered to date. From the Eastern Khanate's role in the fall of the Sui dynasty, through the Turkish emperors who founded the Tang dynasty, through the assimilation of the Eastern Turks into the Tang system, the revolt and the foundation of the Second Khanate, the Tang Protectorate General to pacify the West, and the Tang hegemony over the Western Turks. Think about how important it was to Suluk to get Tang recognition as Khan, even as he ruled in Central Asia on the other side of the mountains and battled with the Umayyads. How his failure in war with the Tang was really the start of his fall. The Chinese state and Chinese civilization have continued to play an absolutely critical part of the story of the Turks all the way through this podcast. One way to think about what's been happening to the Turkish world is that the emergence of Islamic civilization and the creation of the mighty Umayyad Caliphate created a second sort of gravitational pull. And because of this, ever since the Muslim conquest of Iran, the Turks have been oscillating between these two gravitational pulls. Like a planet in one of those solar systems you read about with more than one star, being tossed and turned and worked upon by the immense gravity of these two suns. Well, that ends today, at least for the Turks who are the subject of our story. Because today, we are going to be discussing how the Chinese would come to lose the war for Central Asia, leaving the Turks to be drawn inexorably into the orbit of Islamic civilization. And as we will come to see, just as the Turks played an absolutely critical role in the Abbasid Revolution, they will play a critical role here. Indeed, in some sense, you could say that the Turks ultimately chose which side would be victorious, though none of the people at the time would have seen it that way or understood this as being such a choice. Okay, so what have the Chinese been up to ever since we really last checked in on them? Well, remember that the headline story with respect to Chinese relations with the steppe world is that Tang influence over the steppe was diminished by the revolt of the Eastern Turks and the establishment of the Second Turkish Khanate in 682. We discussed this in detail in Episode 8, of course. From this point on, the Tang ability to control the steppe directly became increasingly limited. During the chaotic regency and reign of Empress Wu, Tang power weakened outside of their garrisons in the Tarim Basin as the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, and others became more and more powerful. For the Tang, this meant that they had to increasingly look to their steppe allies to dominate the West, most importantly the Uyghur Khanate that they had helped bring into existence, and which they would later use to finally defeat the remnants of the Western Göktürk. Throughout this time, as their control of Inner Asia and the steppe weakened, the Tang dynasty was primarily turned inwards. As we discussed in Episode 8, the regency of Empress Wu brought about a period of great instability in the center of China. After her fall in 705, her son became emperor, but he was a weak emperor, dominated by his wife and the women of his harem, a feature that we will see pop up again in Turkish history, but at the other end of Eurasia. Political turmoil and intrigue continued until eventually Empress Wu's grandson came to the throne as Emperor Xuanzong in 712. And again, deepest apologies for mispronouncing that. I'm sure I didn't get that right. Emperor Xuanzong would go on to reign for over 40 years, and his reign would mark the zenith of the Tang Empire's power, prosperity, and its cultural flowering. Emperor Xuanzong would go down as one of the wisest and most benevolent rulers in Chinese history, even abolishing the death penalty. So as the Tang dynasty was beginning to find its footing again, as the turn inwards brought about by the decades of instability ended, as Emperor Xuanzong's rule stabilized and the Tang became increasingly confident, once again, the court at Chang'an could look out across the frontier into the north and the west. And they did not like what they saw. Emperor Xuanzong came to power just at the same time that Qutaiba was running the board in Central Asia, and the second Khanate was kicking in the teeth of the Turgesh at Bolchu. So the Chinese were greatly concerned both about the powerful Arab state that had arisen in the West, the seemingly invincible armies of Islam, and the great second Khanate to the north, a powerful steppe empire, albeit of a sort that the Chinese had experience dealing with. It was in this context that the Tang eventually came to recognize and then make their peace with Suluk Khan. They wanted to use him as a bulwark against the Second Khanate and the Arabs. All in all, despite their recurring problems with Suluk and his refusal to play the part of loyal vassal, the Tang were more or less happy with his ability to keep the armies of Islam in check. But then Suluk lost at Khuristan in 737, and his rule over the Turgesh Khanate began to unravel. In the classic pattern of Turkish steppe states, when the victories stopped, when the flow of plunder ceased, the internal tensions within the confederation began to boil over. In this case, the rivalry between the black and the yellow Turgesh. And remember that all of this was happening just as the second Khanate was entering into its death throes to the north. Bilge Khan had been assassinated in 734, and his son Tengri Khan was now a child Khan under the regency of Tanyukuk's daughter, El Bilge Khatun, a regency that was deeply resented by the patriarchal lords of the Ashna clan in the Second Khanate. So now Emperor Xuanzong had a problem, namely heightened instability on both his western and northern frontiers, but also a great opportunity. The fall of Suluk and the tottering regency running the Second Khanate could be used, exploited. The Tang Empire, now resurgent, with the decades of political crisis behind it, could take advantage of this chaos to reassert its power over the steppe, the power that it had held back in the glory days of Emperors Gaozu and Taizong. And then, Emperor Xuanzong could finally take the fight to the Arab newcomers, now impetuously ruling the lands of Central Asia. After decades of retreat, decades of weakness on the frontiers, decades of watching the Second Khanate and the Turgesh and the Caliphate advance in all directions, the Tang were back. So starting with the Turgesh, as Suluk returned from his defeat horribly weakened, the Tang began fielding messengers from his Yabgu, Kulchur. As we discussed in episode 13, they eventually came to agree to support Kulchur in overthrowing Suluk, following which Kulchur assassinated Suluk in 738. Kulchur then proclaimed himself Khan. But of course this was not universally accepted among the Turgesh. a leader of the Black Turdagesh named Dumoji instead proclaimed Suluk's son Tuhozian as Khan in Suyab, the semi-capital of the Turdagesh near modern-day Bishkek. Then a third contender appeared, Erwe Tegin, who proclaimed himself Khan in a place called Talas. A little bit of foreshadowing. So the Turdagesh Khanate descended into civil war. In the words of Al-Tabari, the Turks then split into factions, making raids on one another. It was likely around this time that Kulchor fought Nasr ibn Sayyar to a draw in the Fergana Valley, which actually ended Turdagesh hopes of maintaining control over the Sogdian city-states of Central Asia. Now in dire straits, Kulchor desperately pleaded with the Tang for aid. And Emperor Xuanzang responded, knowing that this was his chance to extend Tang influence and power in the West. He could back the winning candidate, and perhaps even dominate the Turdagesh completely. So the Tang sent massive contingents of troops westwards to support Kulchor. This support had the intended effect, and Kulchor was able to win the civil war relatively quickly, helped along not just by the Tang, but by the Tang-allied king of Tashkent, who was still resisting the Muslims at this time. The combined forces of Kulchor and his Tang and Sogdian allies managed to sack Suyab in autumn 739 and capture Suluk's son, Tuhozian. Tuhozian was then shipped off to Chang'an, where Emperor Xuanzang, in accordance with his anti-capital punishment stance, ordered him to be ritually executed. You know, instead of actually executed. After this ritual execution, Tuhozian was packed off with a Tang pension to live the rest of his life in obscurity. Though the sources are a little bit unclear, it appears that Dumoji, the leader of the Black Turdagesh who had plopped Tuhozian on the throne in Suyab in the first place, was also packed off to Chang'an, where Emperor Xuanzang would keep him in his back pocket, just in case he needed an alternative to rule the Turdagesh. After the defeat of Suluk's son and his backer Dumoji, Kulchor then turned to the other claimant, Erwe Tegin on the River Talas. Again with Tang and Sogdian aid, Kulchor was able to finish off Erwe Tegin in a minor battle on the River Talas, which I promise you will not be the last battle on that river that we will discuss. So by 741, Kulchor had cemented his rule of the Turdagesh, and now asked the Tang for recognition as Khan, something that he had no doubt been bothering the Tang officials about for some time. But the Tang remembered what had happened with Suluk. After he had come to power and been granted recognition, he became something of a problem. No doubt very useful in holding off the caliphate, but not a quiet vassal. The Turdagesh had been a power to be reckoned with, not a people to be ordered around. So instead of recognizing Kulchor, Emperor Xuanzang decided to try to resurrect the old practice used back in the glory days of the great protectorate general to pacify the West. He tried to appoint an Ashna puppet to the throne of the Turdagesh, one of the multitude of Ashna princes living in the Tang court, Ashna Zin, was packed off to be sent to the West to rule over the Turdagesh. No doubt a change in scenery from the glorious palaces of Chang'an. But Kulchor, upon hearing the news, predictably freaked out about this and threatened to launch a revolt. The Tang then tried to play for time. They ended up reluctantly recognizing Kulchor as Khan in 741 while simultaneously preparing for his removal. So a year later, in 742, judging that they had better prepared the Turdagesh nobility and that they had scraped together enough soldiers to get the job done, the Tang finally carted Ashna Zin west, whereupon Kulchor promptly had him assassinated within a couple of months, making Ashna Zin probably the shortest-serving Ashna Khan we've covered. The Tang were now fed up with Kulchor, so they turned to Dumoji, that leader of the Black Turdagesh who had installed Suluk's son as Khan before being defeated and dragged off to Chang'an. Dumoji was placed in the baggage train of a Tang army, which marched west and defeated Kulchor in 743. Dumoji was then installed as Khan of the Turdagesh. But by now, after years of civil war and defeat at the hands of the Tang, the Khanate was a shadow of its former self, and, just like the Uyghur Khanates to its south and its east, this weakened Khanate was now a loyal vassal of the Tang. Then, as we covered in more detail in Episode 8, in 744, one of the Shahs of the Second Khanate, fed up with the regency of El Bilge Khatun, managed to assassinate her son and charge Tengri Khan. This then sparked a civil war and an uprising supported by the Tang, and the Tang dynasty's Uyghur, Kardluk, and Basmal allies managed to destroy the second Khanate. The Uyghurs now emerged completely triumphant in the east as solid vassals and allies of the Tang. Shortly after the defeat of the second Khanate, the Uyghurs then turned on their erstwhile allies, and the Kardluks were driven into the west. There, the Kardluks quickly achieved prominence over the fading Turgesh. By the late 740s, the Kardluks had replaced the Turgesh to become the dominant tribal confederation in the west. And the Kardluks, like the Uyghurs, were Tang vassals and allies. Finally, in 747, the Tang launched a great campaign against the Tibetan Empire. Now, the Tibetans have been popping in and out of our story, and I probably didn't give them their due earlier, solely because the focus of this podcast is the Turks. But like I've said a couple of times, the Tibetans had formed a powerful kingdom during the late 7th century, one that was variously allied with Suluk and the other steppe peoples. The Tibetans had swept down from the Tibetan plateau to conquer key cities and garrisons in the Tarim Basin and in Gansu province, and even territories in what is today northern Pakistan. Well, in 747, after having dealt with the Turks, Emperor Xuanzang decided to deal with the Tibetans. He organized a Tang army over 10,000 strong, which attacked the city of Bolu and Gilgit in modern-day Pakistan. The Tibetans and their local allies were defeated in a cunning three-pronged attack organized by a brilliant general named Gao Xinji. Remember that name, he's coming up again later in the episode. The Tibetans were routed, and Tibetan hegemony over the Pamir Mountains was ended. The Chinese sources report that 72 cities in what is now Afghanistan and Pakistan came under Tang dominance, extending the Tang's power to the very borders of Arab-dominated Central Asia. So yet again, nearly 80 years after the fall of the original Western Göktürk Khanate and the original triumph of Tang arms in Central Asia, the Tang had again succeeded in pacifying the West. Of the old Tang vassals and possessions in the West, only the Silk Road cities of Transoxiana remained out of Tang hands, being ruled by the Caliphate since the fall of Suluk. The writ of the Tang now extended west across the Tian Shan and into Central Asia and into what is now Afghanistan and Pakistan. It ended only where the Arab Caliphate began, an Arab Caliphate now racked by civil war and embroiled in the Third Fitna. And so it was that in 750, just off his victories over the Turgesh, the Second Khanate, and the Tibetans, a messenger came to Emperor Xuanzang in Chang'an from a local king in the Fergana Valley, one of the very last Tang vassals in Transoxiana who had not submitted to the Arabs. He had gotten into a fight with the Kingdom of Tashkent, now an Arab vassal, after being forced to submit to Nasser ibn Sayyar, and he desperately needed Tang aid. But the messenger also bore remarkable news. News the king of Fergana hoped would convince the Tang to come to his aid. The greatest army of the Caliphate, and the one nearest to China, a great Central Asian army called the Men of the Black Raiments, led by a mysterious man named Abu Muslim, had decamped entirely from Central Asia. They had left with haste to travel across Iran and all the way to the semi-mythical lands of Syria to fight for the throne in the civil war, racking the Caliphate. The lands of Transoxiana, the great Silk Road cities of the West, were virtually unguarded. Now was the perfect time to strike, to reassert Tang dominance. Emperor Xuanzang knew that this opportunity was too good to miss. Indeed, it was so perfect, heaven seemed to have arranged it. Just as his dynasty had completed its reassertion of power on the steppe after decades of weakness, at this very moment, his principal rival had abandoned the walls, abandoned the gates. And so with all possible speed, Emperor Xuanzang assembled an army to march west and seize the lands of Sogdiana, the lands that had once upon a time been the vassals of his most illustrious forebearer, the Emperor Taizong. He would see to it that all of Central Asia returned to the rule of the Tang, and these Arabs were driven back to whence they had come. Now, our sources are a bit muddled on the composition of the Tang army, but it seems that in all likelihood, it was an army around 30,000 strong. The core of the army probably consisted of approximately 10,000 professional Tang soldiers. Now, as we've covered in the past, the Tang military was, for decades, built around Turkish steppe soldiers, but steppe soldiers in the service of the Chinese state. But this was no longer really the case. As the Second Khanate had conquered large parts of Inner Asia and drawn Turks out of the service of the empire, the Tang armies became less and less Turkish. Additionally, in the century or so since the founding of the dynasty, the Turks remaining in service under the Tang had of course become progressively cooked, as we have called it. So the differences between them and the Han Chinese troops were really not that large. These were not Turkish troops raised in the saddle, as in the days of old. There's an indication in the Tang sources that the Tang were increasingly relying on conscripted Chinese soldiers to serve as infantry in lieu of the steppe cavalry that had formed the core of the military during the early years of the dynasty. Indeed, Chinese sources indicate a relatively small number of horses for the Tang troops in the army Xuanzang sent to the west, implying that these were not steppe warriors, but Chinese-style infantry. But the Tang did not just give up on steppe-style troops as they themselves became more cooked and lost the ability to field homegrown steppe power. Instead, they augmented their core Chinese troops with steppe warriors from allies, the Karluks, the Uyghurs, the Khitan, and so on. And these auxiliaries would often outnumber the actual Tang troops. In this campaign, the army of 10,000 Tang troops that Emperor Xuanzang was to send west was augmented by more than 20,000 steppe troops, composed primarily of Karluks. And remember, the Karluks were a Turkic people, speaking a language that would evolve into Uzbek in time. So while the Tang had lost the ability to field native Turkish steppe armies, they could still assemble them from their Turkish vassals. But as we will come to see, there's a real difference between your army and your vassal's army. The army was placed under the command of Emperor Xuanzang's top three generals. Interestingly, and in line with Tang practice, all three generals seem to have had non-Han roots. Now, I already mentioned Gao Xianji, the man who had overall control of the army and who had led the campaign against Tibet. He was of Korean descent, while his subordinates Li Siyi and Duan Zhuxi seem to have been Sinicized Turks. But all three were among the most cooked of all barbarians, as the Chinese would have seen it. Gao and Li had distinguished themselves in the Tibetan campaign of 747, and were therefore the obvious choices for this second great campaign in the West. To me, this kind of shows how even after the Tang dynasty had become more or less completely Chinese by this point, its Turkish steppe origins, its multicultural background, made it unusually cosmopolitan for a Chinese dynasty. The main Tang army of 10,000 assembled somewhere near Kucha in the Tarim Basin. They then marched north, crossing the Tian Shan through the northern passes out to the north of the Tarim Basin. Once on the other side, they were joined by their Karluk vassals, and the whole army began marching west, passing the Turgesh capital of Suyab and leaving the snow-capped mountains of the Tian Shan to their left. As the Tang began to march steadily westwards towards Central Asia, the lands of Transoxiana brought into the caliphate after the fall of Suluk, messengers raced to Syria to carry the news to Abu Muslim and the men of the Black Raiments, who had oh so recently succeeded in overthrowing the Umayyad Caliphate. I imagine a breathless messenger barging into a feast in a great Damascus palace, where Abu Muslim and his Abbasid masters are in the midst of celebrating their great victory over the Umayyads and urgently shouting out his terrifying news. The Caliphate's vassal in Tashkent was facing an incoming Tang assault. An assault led by a massive army that could not just sack Tashkent, but that could ravage all of Central Asia. Upon hearing the news, Abu Muslim realized that he had to act. Central Asia was his home base, the place he had assembled his revolutionary army, and where the support for the Abbasids was the strongest, he could not let it fall. A defeat at the hands of the Tang could very well mean not just the loss of Tashkent, or even all of Central Asia, as horrible as that would be, but the resumption of the Third Fitna, perhaps even the return of the Umayyads, now bottled up in Spain and the farthest western reaches of North Africa. So Abu Muslim acted as quickly as he could. He marshaled all of the forces he could immediately get his hands on and began racing back east as fast as possible. In the meantime, as Abu Muslim and the Abbasids were desperately assembling their forces, Gao Xianji brought his army to the walls of Tashkent, the largest frontier border city at the very edges of the Caliphate's domains. The Abbasid garrison put up a stiff resistance, but were ultimately unable to withstand the might of the Tang force. The city fell, but held out long enough to slow the Tang advance. As Gao Xianji entered Tashkent in triumph, the Abbasid commander of the local garrison managed to make a break for it and fled to Samarkand to raise troops for a counter-attack. Likely he also dashed off messages to the Kingdom of Tibet, trying to convince them to launch an attack on the Tang from the south as soon as humanly possible. But by now, Gao Xianji had heard that an Abbasid army led by the mysterious Abu Muslim was racing east. So he left Tashkent and traveled south and east through the passes into the Ferghana Valley, the land of the Tang vassal king who had called him west in the first place, where he recruited further Carluk troops, bringing the total number of troops under his control to a total of about 30 to 40,000. With his army thus strengthened, Gao Xianji marched back out of the Ferghana Valley, passing Tashkent, towards Suyab, likely in an attempt to raise further steppe troops to face the coming Abbasids. But as the Tang army was halfway back from Tashkent to Suyab, Chinese scouts reported the presence of the vanguard of the rapidly approaching Abbasid army. Gao Xianji received the news as he was approaching the river Talas and decided, fatefully, that this would be where the Tang would turn and give battle. Unfortunately, we know little about the Abbasid army that Abu Muslim had assembled. The Book of Tang says that it numbered 200,000 strong, but that's certainly a vast exaggeration, a way to excuse what's about to happen to the Tang troops. Modern historians estimate that the Abbasid army was somewhere between 30 to 50,000 strong, so roughly the same size as the Tang army. The main army was likely composed of those same men, the men of the black raiments, who had overthrown the Umayyads mere months before. That is, it was a combined arms force, composed of a mixture of Arab and Iranian infantry, complemented by a large contingent of Turkish cavalry. But we also know that, like the Tang, Abu Muslim had worked furiously to augment his troops with further non-Muslim Turkish steppe warriors. The fearsome reputation of the Turks, which would come to shape so much of Abbasid history, was already well established in both East and West. And so it was that in July 751, on the banks of the river Talas, the armies of the Abbasid Caliphate faced off with the armies of the Tang dynasty. The first and only major confrontation between the armies of Islam and the Chinese state in a battle to decide who would control Central Asia. We know frustratingly little about the battle given its importance to world history. Our sources are limited to a fleeting reference in the New Book of Tang, a couple of lines in the Book of Sung, fragments of text preserved in the histories of Al-Maqdisi and Al-Kamil, and fragments of a memoir by a Chinese captive who was taken back to Iraq, where he lived for over a decade before returning to China. There's also a confused reference in Al-Tabari's history, but one that is most likely a misunderstanding or corruption of the sources relied upon by Al-Tabari. Based on these limited sources, here's what we know about the battle. The armies engaged along the river Talas, but were evenly matched. After several days of stalemate, characterized by offenses and counteroffenses that accomplished little, the Carluks defected to the Abbasids from the Tang. We know nothing about what Abu Muslim promised the Carluks in order to get them to switch sides. The Chinese sources imply that this happened all of a sudden, but the Arab sources lay out a far more likely process, that this was agreed upon between the Carluks and the Arabs beforehand. Regardless, their decision to defect sealed the fate of the Tang army. As the Karluk auxiliaries to the Tang outnumbered the Tang regular troops 2-1, this was a crippling blow to the Tang. The Karluks were now able to attack from the flanks, as Abu Muslim ordered an all-out frontal assault by the Abbasid troops. Seeing the treachery of the Karluks and recognizing that victory was impossible, Gao Jianji ordered a retreat. As the Tang troops fled, Karluk and Abbasid Turkish troops spread out and began to cut them down. Only a valiant rearguard action led by Li Siyi was able to stop the Turks from utterly destroying the Tang army. Out of an original army of 10,000 Tang regular troops, less than 2,000 managed to flee back to China. According to the sources, 20,000 Chinese prisoners were taken, at least some of whom were sent back to Iraq. But this is certainly an exaggeration, as the core of the Chinese army itself was likely not more than 10,000. Regardless, no doubt many were killed and enslaved. Some of the enslaved Chinese troops would even go on to assist in the coming construction of Baghdad. The less lucky were probably those enslaved by the Karluks, destined to live out their lives traveling with the nomads across the steppe and performing grueling and demeaning housework, or maybe we should say tent work. Much has been made and said about the Battle of Talas. In the past, historians traditionally pointed to Talas as the turning point, the key battle that ended Chinese hopes in Central Asia. Now, this is clearly not correct, as indeed the Tang would continue to send troops to the west for a couple more years. It wouldn't be until the coming An Lushan Rebellion, which we'll get to very shortly, that Chinese hopes for Central Asia were truly dashed. But there is still no doubt that Talas was nevertheless something of a turning point, both because it demonstrated to the Tang just how formidable the armies of Islam were, and because it secured Abbasid rule over the Central Asian city-states immediately following the revolution. Talas was also a critical part of Turkish history for another reason. By turning on the Tang and delivering victory to the Abbasids, the Karluks had cemented their position over the Turgesh as the leading power of the Western Turks. The Battle of Talas would set the stage for their coming Khanate, which we will discuss in more detail in a later episode. Though we continue to see references to the Turgesh in Chinese records, the Turgesh Khanate became, in essence, little more than a Khanate located around the city of Suyab, until it, too, fell to the Karluks in 766. And as we will discuss next time, crucially for our story, it was in fleeing the Karluk ascendancy that a people called the Oghuz Turks would emerge, the people who would come to settle in Anatolia. Talas also had an impact within China, particularly in changing the perception of Western conquest among a large segment of the Tang elite. The great historian of Tang poetry, Arthur Whaley, has made the argument that some of the poetry of the Tang court following Talas shows many in the Chinese court asking why the Tang are involved so far west. Why are we spending blood and treasure for these barbaric places on the fringe of the empire? In particular, the great poet Po Chu'i wrote a lengthy poem titled On Stopping the War, directly arguing the Western campaigns were poorly managed and pointless. Sort of similar to how in the early 2000s, many Americans asked why their sons were being sent to die in Iraq and Afghanistan, places of basically no importance to the average person at home, and why the Bush administration did such a horrible job actually prosecuting the war. To me, these sentiments kind of also show the extent to which the Tang were really becoming Chinese, the way they really had become just cooked. To a totally Han audience, caring about the steppe world, caring about the Far West didn't matter at all, didn't make any sense. But this feeling was not universal. After the defeat at Talas, the defeated Tang general Gao Jianji began plotting his revenge. He hoped to convince the emperor to assemble an army that he could lead west again, to break the Abbasid armies in Central Asia. The following poem was composed by the Tang poet Tu Fo shortly after Talas, arguing that Gao Jianji must be sent back to the west to avenge the defeat. It says in part, "The military protector of Anji's blue colt, suddenly the noise of its reputation came flying from west to east. It is said that no enemy could stand as this horse approached their ranks. By resolution as firm as its master's hand, it had won the great fight. When the battle was over, it was carefully tended and allowed to go where it wished. Swiftly, it came from over a far country of shifting sands. But its dauntless frame would not receive the kindness of stabled ease. Its bold spirit was brooding still on the contests of the battlefield. Shall it never again find cause to issue by the road of the Western Gate? But it was not to be, because a mere 4 years after Talos, a rebellion would erupt inside Tang China that would finish what Talos started, and actually spell the final end of the Tang attempts to dominate the West. And indeed, it would almost break the Tang dynasty. And just as with the Battle of Talos and the Abbasid Revolution to the West, the Turks would play a key role in this rebellion. The rebellion that would rock the Tang dynasty in 755 takes its name from its leader, An Lushan. An Lushan was a half-Turkish, half-Sogdian official within the Tang court. Remember, the Tang dynasty was originally founded by a Turkish family, and it was unusually cosmopolitan for a Chinese dynasty. There were non-Han nobles throughout the state apparatus, particularly those of Turkish origin or other northern or western origin, people like Mongols, Tibetans, and Sogdians. This reflected the origins of the Li family itself, the founders of the dynasty, people from the northern and western frontiers. An Lushan was one of these nobles. His mother was a princess of the Ashina clan, the old ruling family of the first and second Khanates, while his father was a Sogdian noble of relatively obscure origins. Now, because he's about to go on to lead a revolt that would almost destroy the Tang dynasty, later Chinese histories are almost entirely negative about him. This means it's really hard to get an objective view of who he was. He's always depicted in Chinese paintings as a hairy barbarian with ugly and distorted features. And no joke, the Chinese sources spend an inordinate amount of time talking about how fat he was. Here's one of my favorite descriptions of him. His stomach hung below his knees, and he weighed 330 catties, that is almost 200 kilos. When he walked, he would put his arms around his attendants' shoulders to support his weight. Only then could he move about. But when he came before Emperor Xuanzang, he'd perform the barbarian whirlwind dance, quick as the wind. An Lushan appears to have risen through the Tang military in his youth, ultimately becoming a frontier military governor. His annual reviews by the Tang military bureaucracy say that he was a man of impartiality, honesty, and unselfishness. As a competent and trustworthy soldier, he continued to rise through the Tang military before catching the eye of the emperor and his favorite consort, upon which his career really skyrocketed. The imperial court found his supposedly rough manners and barbarian bluntness endearing, and he was known for his personal charisma and his willingness to speak his mind, even to the emperor, telling him things that he did not want to hear. An Lushan eventually came to be one of the two most trusted advisors of the emperor. But as can be expected, he quickly became a bitter rival of the other most trusted advisor, a preening and sophisticated Han courtier named Yang Guozhang. An Lushan's rough manner and barbarian origin were detested by Yang Guozhang, who conspired against him with the support of the crown prince. Eventually, through a twisting series of court intrigues I'm not going to get into, in the last year of Emperor Xuanzang's life, as he began to slip a little bit with age, Yang Guozhang managed to have An Lushan removed from court and placed out on the frontiers as a commanding general. No doubt, he thought that this was a more fitting place for a barbarian general. But it was also a huge, huge mistake, as it gave An Lushan access to large armies. Yang Guozhang then managed to have An Lushan's mansion at court seized, all of its inhabitants arrested, and his sons executed. He then sent out an order for An Lushan himself to be executed. This prompted An Lushan's revolt. Claiming that he actually held a secret order from the dying emperor to have Yang Guozhang arrested, An Lushan mustered a massive force of his frontier troops. He surrounded the large Tang garrison in Hebei province and declared himself as emperor of a new dynasty, the failed Yan dynasty. An Lushan drew on popular discontent with the Tang court's luxury, the cruelty and unpopularity of Yang Guozhang, and the resentments of the peripheral peoples of the Tang state in particular Turks like himself. Anlushan's rebellion would seize huge regions of China, including briefly capturing the imperial capital of Chang'an, where he would execute the emperor's sisters and perform a traditional Turkish sacrifice of their body parts to appease the death of his son. But it wasn't just that Turks made up a large part of his armies, or that he himself was partially Turkish. One of my history professors in university made the argument that Anlushan likely saw his rebellion in terms of a Turkish succession struggle. As we've discussed over and over again, the Turks would never really develop clear rules of succession. Any member of the royal clan was entitled to the throne, if they could win it. As Emperor Xuanzang weakened and approached his death, the two rival camps for power were Yang Guozhang and the crown prince on the one hand, and Anlushan on the other. And so Anlushan did the totally normal Turkish thing. He started a war for the throne. It just turns out that this war would last for decades, almost destroy the Tang dynasty, and fatally cripple its ability to operate in the West. In a manner also totally in keeping with Turkish dynastic politics, Anlushan himself was killed by his own son, 2 years after starting his revolt. His obesity and bad eyesight had become a liability. The revolt would continue to rage for another 5 years. It would drag on through the reigns of 3 Tang emperors and 4 Yen pretenders. It was probably the biggest war in history to that point, estimated to have caused somewhere around 20 million deaths. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of the revolt, as this is not a Chinese history podcast. Again, you should really listen to the History of China podcast. It's amazing. What's important for us is how Anlushan's rebellion affected Central Asia and the western regions of China. And the big story here is that the ability of the Tang to contest the rule of Central Asia was finished. The troops were all withdrawn from the frontiers of the empire to return to the center to put down Anlushan. Gao Xianji, instead of getting his army to avenge himself on the Abbasids, was put in charge of a force to defeat Anlushan, and ultimately ended up being executed after losing a major engagement as a result of wartime hysteria and the twists of fate. In desperation, the Tang court sent a royal prince to the Uyghurs to plead for aid. The Uyghur Khan had taken advantage of the disorder after Talas and the withdrawal of Tang troops to conquer most of the steppe zone of Inner Asia east of the Tian Shan and the Altai. He had even started to build a capital city, Karabagalsun, in the old heartland of the first and second Turkish Khanates, in the holy mountains of Otukan. In doing this, he was laying claim to the legacy of the old Turkish Khanates. He agreed to assist the Tang, and sent his Yabgu to aid the Tang in China, while he himself rode out to defeat Anlushan's steppe allies. But the Uyghurs exacted a heavy price for their aid. In addition to massive tribute payments, they insisted on being allowed to loot liberated cities, aside from the capital of Chang'an. The Book of Tang records the sack of Luoyang. The Uyghurs pillaged the eastern capital savagely for 3 days. Evil men led them around, and treasure houses were stripped bare. The Tang crown prince wanted to stop them, but he could not. However, the elders of the city bribed the Uyghurs with enormous quantities of silken fabric and embroidery, and got them to discontinue the pillage. The Uyghur Khanate was thus greatly strengthened through aiding the Tang, just as the Tang were weakened. And thus, in the power vacuum in the western regions of China, the Uyghur Khanate would sweep in. And just as the Uyghurs established their powerful Khanate, the Tibetan kingdom would wax in power, conquering huge swaths of the lowland to the north of the Tibetan plateau. Further to the west, the Karluks would establish themselves in the old heartlands of the Turgesh, while even further to the west, Abbasid control over the rich lands of Central Asia was now confirmed. The Tang dynasty, the first Turkish imperial dynasty in the world, had lost its western lands, the lands where most Turks had come to live. Additionally, the Anlushan rebellion had the unintended side effect of effectively breaking the Silk Road trade. As violence erupted across Inner Asia and the Uyghur Khanate, the Karluks, and the Tibetan Kingdom separated Tang China from Central Asia, trade between China and the Middle East increasingly came to be dominated by the sea. Maritime trade, via India, became the main linkage between the Middle East and China. Instead, the formerly Silk Road cities of Central Asia increasingly began to deal in trade with the North, acting as the connection between the Middle East and India and the lands of modern-day Russia as furs, timbers, and slaves moved south and silver, gold, and spices moved north. This had the effect of further separating the peoples of Central Asia from China, and the two lands drifted further apart. And as we will discuss in detail next time, it was also in the new steppe world created in the aftermath of Talas and the Anlushan Rebellion that the Oghuz Turks, the Turks whose descendants would come to settle in Anatolia, emerged as a people. Thus it was that the Turks passed definitively from the orbit of Chinese civilization and into the world of the emerging Islamic civilization, at least the Western Turks that we care about for our story. But even those Turkic peoples like the Uyghurs that remained in deep communication and contact with China, and whose societies continued to be orientated towards China, came to adopt Islam in the end, acting as a bridge and a link between the two worlds. And as I said at the top of the episode, in some sense, this was the path chosen by the Turks at the time, though none of them would really have understood it as such. The Turgesh War with the Umayyads unknowingly laid the ground for the Abbasid Revolution. The Turkish troops, who joined Abu Muslim and the men of the Black Raiments to defeat the Umayyad Caliphate, played a critical role in the victory of the Abbasids. This allowed Abu Muslim's version of Islam, divorced from Arab supremacy, to become the version of Islam that succeeded. This led to the flowering of a truly universal and cosmopolitan Islamic culture that the Turks would join in creating. Perhaps most dramatically, it was the decision of the Karluks to turn on the Tang at Talas that led to the defeat of the Tang armies. And further to the east, it was the half-Turkish Anlushan and his largely Turkish troops who unwittingly and unintentionally broke the Tang dynasty's ability to dominate Central Asia, which ultimately led to the Abbasid domination of the region and the definitive movement of the Turks into the Islamic world. So next time, we will discuss the steppe world in the aftermath of Talas and the Anlushan Rebellion, because it is from this new steppe world that the coming Turkish domination of Islamic civilization would begin. And we will finally welcome onto the stage the subjects of our story, the people who will go on to build the Seljuk Empire and eventually settle in Anatolia, the Oghuz Turks.